This morning's lecture, I think, requires a slight preamble to establish a setting which is concerned with our problem. According to the Greek mythology, the deity Hermes was the son of Zeus and Maia, one of the daughters of Atlas. He was originally a deity of agriculture and fertility. But in the course of the rise and sophistication of Greek culture, he was raised to the station of the messenger of the gods. As such, he is generally depicted with wings on his heels, a winged helmet, and carrying a caduceus, which has since been associated with the medical profession. Hermes was one of the more benevolent deities and was often associated with the principle of knowledge. Also, the communication of messages from the heavenly worlds to the abodes of mortals. When the Romans dominated the area, they knew Hermes as Mercury, a god of swiftness, of messages, and to a sense of the ability to read the human mind. In the meantime, the Ptolemaic dynasty in Alexandria in North Africa began to associate the concept of Hermes and Mercury with the deity of the Egyptians, Thoth, the god of writing, who was called also the scribe of the heavenly assembly of the Osirian rites. So we now have a deity that by the beginning of the Christian era was known under three names and who was to become a tremendously important psychological force in the origin and descent of what we term today as mysticism. The names were brought together in a curious way to create in Alexandria a hypothetical person who was known to these people as Thoth Hermes Trismegistus. Trismegistus meaning the three times great. No one seems to be quite sure when Hermes lived. They cannot give us any evidence as to whether he is simply a composite of earlier beliefs or whether there actually was a person by that name, or that some sage took that name. One thing is certain, however, he became the personification of the wisdom of the world. He was believed to be the true author of all the books that were ever written, because actually all of these books depend upon a dimension of wisdom, a power of knowledge, man's capacity to think, to learn, to know, and to transmit. He also became, in particular, the guardian of what was called the Hermetic Arts. And the Hermetic Arts have descended to us as chemistry, astronomy, music, geography, and medicine. Now, this in itself is very interesting, especially when we find that this mysterious being, whoever he was, had also left a series of books or writings especially attributed to himself. This was the Hermetic literature. And the most important of the Hermetic books was The Shepherd of Man, a mysterious dialogue between Hermes and universal mind. Where it came from and how it was compiled is one of the unsolved mysteries of history. But one thing is rather evident. It first came into prominence, first came to be known, and first came to be venerated in Alexandria, about the beginning of the Christian era. This mysterious book, The Shepherd of Men, brings in another dimension, because in many of the old representations of Hermes, He is shown carrying a lamb on his shoulder and also carrying a shepherd's crook, thus tying him to the concept of the good shepherd and the shepherd of men. This mysterious being came to have a very profound influence upon the development of knowledge. He was one of several composite beings or persons developed among the Alexandrian Gnosis and the Neoplatonists to personify forms of learning and attitudes toward truth, the search for realities. Our knowledge today on Hermeticism is largely centered in alchemy, and also, of course, in the works of the Rosicrucians and the Kabbalists. All of these groups consider Hermes as their patron saint. He is the mysterious power by means of which the esoteric truths of sciences came to be made available to humanity. Now, at a long ago period when problems were not as complex as they are today, our forebears had a certain attitude toward knowledge which has been called hermetic. Hermetic, as we use it now, means to seal or to close tightly. And we can hermetically seal a bottle or a package. But in those days, it has a somewhat larger implication. Hermeticism was a system of thought which placed a very strong line across the advancement of arts and sciences. The theory behind Hermeticism is quite simple, yet today remains as much unfulfilled or misunderstood as it was in ancient times. The Hermetic doctrine is based upon the belief that all existing things are locked within containers. They are hermetically sealed. Among the most important of these sealed things is the solar system. Another very important and closed material locked in a bottle is the planet Earth. And a third sealed mysterious container is man himself. Now, this mysterious container, which locks all things within its own nature, makes it necessary for everything to save itself. Every problem of existence has its solution within it. Solutions do not come from the outside. They come from the inside. For example, we have today chemistry, which is a very important branch of learning. The Hermetists would have said that, frankly, modern chemistry is locked in a bottle of its own. It is locked in a small container, and this bottle is the internal attitude of the chemists. Every form of knowledge is controlled by a paternalistic group, a group that has declared itself to be peculiarly qualified to devote its attention to the solution of universal mysteries. Yet, generally speaking, all of the groups, regardless of what mystery they have selected as their province, all of them have failed. They have failed because they have not been able to escape from the little bottle in which they enclosed themselves. They declared what truth had to be. They declared that they had a way to find it. And they also declared that what they found by their way was truth. And the Hermetists would have denied this. They would not have accepted this idea at all. They would not have believed, for example, that it would be possible for science, while oriented to a physical solution of all mysteries, could ever solve anything. Because the answers are not to be found in matter. They are not to be found in the material phases of things. They cannot explore the material structure of the universe long enough to discover what the universe means. They can find out its chemical components. They can discover forms of life evolving. How the life got there, they do not know. What the life actually is, they do not know. What its purpose was in the large plan of things, they do not know. All they are able to do is to classify a pattern, a ladder of unknown facts, and try to discover from this classification the reason for these facts. And it can't be done. Now, the Alexandrians discovered that nearly 2,000 years ago, and probably it was known generally at a still earlier date in various parts of the world. The Alexandrians were fortunate in that their city was at the crossroads between Asia and Europe, and therefore that the wisdom of two hemispheres mingled in their community. Also, several religions functioned there, and many great philosophies were adequately represented. The Alexandrian hermitists followed a pattern which came also from Egypt. The Egyptians had a hieroglyph of a serpent swallowing its own tail. And everybody tried to figure out what that meant. Some gave it up as a pure hallucination. But others, going more carefully into the situation, came to an interesting conclusion that parallels and agrees with the Hermetic conviction. The serpent, by swallowing its tail, is feeding itself, and it has nothing to feed on but itself. And the Hermetists said this is the perfect system and symbol of creation. Existence has nothing to feed upon but itself. We find this in what they later presented to us in the form of the golden chain of Homer. Homer's chain is a chain that links heaven and earth, the material world with the heights of the Olympian deities. It is a series of links, and these links became levels of research. They became levels of consciousness, and perhaps most of all, they became the basis of astronomy and the sidereal geography of space. Now, the idea of something living off of itself can perhaps be best exemplified today by what we call the food chain. If you have been watching the nature pictures and so forth that are among the better things we occasionally get on television, you will realize that every living thing lives from and of other living things, this mysterious food chain, by means of which life living upon life nourishes itself upon itself. And therefore, like the tailed serpent of the Egyptians, is nourished out of its own body. It lives by devouring itself. And yet, at the same time, by this mystery, it becomes a symbol also of eternity and immortality. There is a balance of nature in which nature, continually subsisting from itself, maintains itself. This great cycle of nutrition is probably a symbol that the Neoplatonists and Hermetists of Egypt would have rejoiced in had they been able to put the elements together, or perhaps they did. Anyway, empirically, they knew the facts. They knew also that all forms of knowledge nourish themselves from themselves. If you learn something, this becomes the basis of something else, and the new knowledge is matured or informed by the old. Everything is living upon its own processes, and these processes are all locked within an hermetic retort, a laboratory vessel, and all the transmutations, transmissions of energy and force that make up the planet and its life, and the solar system with its life. All of these things exist sealed within vessels. These vessels, being composed of the outer atmosphere which encloses a planet or the magnetic field of the solar system. So that everything that we see and have is more or less internally generated. It comes to bear its natural fruit because of a system which we call in the human body digestion and assimilation. But to the Hermetists, these words meant the transmutation of forms of life, a chemistry, an occult mystery going on constantly, in which base elements, which are themselves merely physical matter, can be transformed into digestible material by means of which bodies are maintained, and that within the body itself, every mystery that is found in the legends of alchemy and the transmutation of metals within the human body, these legends are lived out as practical, natural, inevitable procedures. Therefore, we have to say for the moment that alchemy, or the transmutation of base metals into gold, is the secret of nutrition. And every time we eat a meal, we are alchemists, but we do not know it. And this problem also gives us the word by which we understand chemistry today. Chemistry is the science of the land of Chem, K-H-E-M. And this land was Egypt. The prefix al, A-L or E-L, E-L in Hebrew, A-L in Arabic, is divine or God, as Elohim. In the opening chapters of Genesis, the deities, or Allah, the Muslim supreme deity, whose name begins with A-L. This A-L prefix means divine. Therefore, alchemy is divine chemistry. It is a chemistry rooted in the mysteries of God, rather than in some physical laboratory. Consequently, to these people, and I think we are beginning to think their way now after a long time, these people believe firmly that without the mystery, the understanding of the mystery of deity, it would never be possible to come to the final conclusion and truth of any art or science. All equally depend upon a divine principle, and this divine principle must be understood before any question relating to knowledge can have its ultimate answer. Up to that point, the answers are all tentative and suppositional. There is no final conclusion. Now, we have just sent a spaceship out to ride around Saturn and Jupiter, and if all goes well, take a long-range peek at Uranus and Neptune. This is going to come back and is going to be regarded as one of the supreme achievements of modern man. We are going to learn more about the motions of these planets. We may learn something of their chemical analysis. We may gain a better dimension and knowledge of the moons that move about them. We may also find something about their temperature or something about the density of the materials of which they are composed. But when we come back with all this information, we are in the same position as the old Arabic philosopher who, surrounded by the wisdom of the world, said, "Man is born, man suffers, and man dies." This is an essential. All the rest seemingly is highly theoretical. It is interesting. It is amazing. It stimulates a certain type of mind. It is magnificent to hold the attention of children, but when all these explorations end, man will still not have the answer to what is life, what is consciousness, what is energy. Its uses we will gain, but the triad of powers that are at the source of all things remain locked forever in the mystery of the divine nature. And therefore, if we are going to explore, if we are going to search for the true answer to things, we have to begin to consider an entirely different approach to our search for realities. The Hermetists, Neoplatonists, and Gnostics, and many other mystical groups of the Far East, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, all these different faiths and doctrines, realized with the words of Omar that from man's own base metal must be filed the key to unlock the door the others howl without. We are all howling outside the gates of knowledge. We are all seeking some way, to use the term of Irenaeus Philalethes, the alchemist, to open the shut palace door of the king. We are looking for the answers to things. And instead of finding answers, we simply find more questions. And the further we research, the greater the number of questions, and the more difficult it is to discover an answer. What then is the answer that the Greeks and the Egyptians decided on? They pointed out that, according to legend, and they in their legendary bestowed great wisdom upon the poet Homer, they pointed out that there was a mysterious chain of links between the earth, which was a kind of island, and the mountain of the gods upon Olympus. This golden chain was what bound heaven and earth. And this golden chain was the pure principle of life itself. And this pure principle of life, the alchemists declared to be the hermetic mercury. They held that mercury, as we know, is a solvent. It dissolves other metals into itself. But this is the base mercury. And alchemy says of all metals, of all substance, in everything in nature, there are two kinds. One the base, and the other the purified. Man himself is composed of elements. And these elements are either in their base condition or in their purified condition. Man also has a mind, which is either a material mind or a purified, regenerated mind. All his emotions, even the cells of his body, go through processes of refinement. And the more refined they become, the more accurately they bear witness to the will of the power within the body. All through alchemy, then, we say, in those days, at least the masters of the subject declared, that there were natural things which were called the prima materia, the base substance of everything. And in this base substance of everything is concealed everything else. There is a dark earth that is matter. And there is a regenerated, redeemed dark earth that is soul power. There is a darkness, which is the darkness of ignorance. And there is the supreme darkness in which all things that are important are concealed from the profane. There are many levels and conditions of the regeneration of substances. But all these regenerations have to take place within the substance itself. This is another lesson that they tried to tell us that is timely at the moment. Many people today are trying to find ways of growing spiritually. And they are following mostly the attitude and processes of other forms of knowledge, like education. They believe that inner light is to be attained by a kind of schooling. They attend classes. They join organizations. They listen carefully to the words of the so-called wise. They read the approved texts. They do all these things assuming that the mystery is going to be communicated. It cannot be communicated, according to the Hermetists. It can only be experienced. The answer has to lie within, inasmuch as man himself is locked within a bottle, and everything that is necessary for his survival is within that bottle. And he must use his own ways of reducing his materialistic pressures and releasing his spiritual convictions and overtones. So we have in the Hermetic philosophy this concept that all things arise from within the forms in which they are generated. All things existing have the seed within themselves for the perpetuation of their material kind. And they also have within themselves the hermetic seed of life, by means of which all forms less than perfection can be gradually brought to perfection by causing this seed to grow. The growth of the seed of divinity within man is also part of the philosophy of Jacob Böhme, the great German mystic. He describes the human soul as a tree with its seed in the heart, which grows from within and finally becomes the basis of the tree of all knowledge and all wisdom, which in the book of Revelation is for the healing of the nations. The seed of the great mystery is in each person. Transmutation, therefore, is a transformation from the person's own experiences. The alchemist was referred to sometimes as Saturn, the gardener. And all the planets were involved in this story. Saturn was the gardener who had to take care of the garden of the soul. He had to weed it and water it. He had to protect it against all forms of invasion. He had to make certain that it was not neglected. Saturn, as the wise counselor, is also, in Oriental and in North African mysticism, the symbol of karma, the symbol of repentance, of repayment, the symbol of the inevitable operation of cause and effect. Therefore, it is Saturn who protects the growth of the seed. He surrounds it with protecting forms. He permits it to be discovered only by the pure of heart. He also, in guarding it, must, if necessary, draw out or take out the weeds that have been allowed to gather there. The weeds being false doctrines, false ideas, false concepts of life that try to squeeze out or destroy the true seeds of wisdom. Now, this same seed has so many meanings. But we remember in the Bible it says, and the seed is the word of God. In this particular meaning, the seed is the root of the inevitable in all things that live. There is no creature, from the tiniest little gnat in the sunbeam to the greatest galaxy of stars, in which the seed of perfection is not present. The seed is the thing that lives, and all the rest is a protection or a husk around the seed. It is the seed that transmits life from generation to generation. It is the seed within which is the final transformer of all things. For everything has within itself, within its own locked nature, the secret and means of its own ultimate perfection. Everything that exists is destined to be perfect. It is destined to fulfill the reason for itself, but it cannot know the reason for itself until it perfects itself. And all the experiences of life which have a tendency to advance the good work, the good deed, is a seed, it is a nutrition, it is a form of life, it is something that helps things to grow. But this growth, this seed of life, this good deed, grows by devouring itself. It eats up itself. It lives off of itself. And every form of growth lives off of itself. Love lives off of itself. It lives not because of its attachments or because of its associations. It grows within itself. And it grows, in a sense, by devouring the lesser aspects of itself as it ascends. This is the food chain that applies to every form of life in nature. Now, among these people also, there were these superior ideas of science. In one of his books, I think if I remember it is the Novum Organum, Lord Bacon points out very clearly that when physics is properly understood, there is no need for metaphysics. Metaphysics is probably, more nearly than anything else, true physics. That which we call physics is a diluted, partial, distorted aspect of a science that is in itself part of the divine plan of things. But no physics can be perfected unless the internal life of the physicist releases the power to understand. The physicist can only understand physics as an experience within himself. And until this experience is available to him, he is still going to be plodding around, trying to advance step by step. Even in this process of advancement, he, whether he knows it or not, is still obeying this law in a strange manner. He is growing by eating up his own predecessors. He is building by devouring the wisdom of those that went before him and casting off most of it. He is constantly growing and building by using the background, the substance, the body of his own science. The physicist is living off of the body of physics. And if he does it correctly and does it long enough, again, physics will become the serpent living from itself and will gradually attain the transmutation that is necessary. The transformation of knowledge implies the presentation of a new, deeper, fuller dimension of knowledge. In our thinking also, we can mention another hermetic field which has need of some work, and that is the field of astronomy, as it particularly applies to the difference between astronomy, astrology, and astrotheology. Astronomy we are pretty well acquainted with. Very few people really understand it. And among those who do not really understand what they are seeing are most of the astronomers. The astrologer believes that he has found has ascended from the physiology to the psychology of the subject. He has discovered something that is not yet fully appreciated either by himself or by physical astronomy. He has discovered that all bodies in space have influence. They have organisms of their own. They are part of something that is inside of another bottle, and that is the solar system. And then this solar system is enclosed in still a larger flask, and that is the cosmos. But each of these levels is self-contained, and every form of ignorance must be transmuted by using its own previous mistakes as the food for its progress. In the highest phase of astrology, we have the astrotheology, which was again developed in Egypt, namely the realization that astrology and all of the elements that compose it is one of the great maps or charts by means of which the universal purpose can be charted. It is not until, however, that the divine meaning of these elements is realized that the astrologer will gain a new dimension, not of skill, but of intuitive and internal spiritual apperception. Music, we know the problem of music. We realize what is happening to it today. We know what is happening to art. All these things are living off of the husks of each other, or upon a material derived from outside sources. The artist is dependent upon the techniques that he learns. These techniques, however, must feed themselves. They must swallow themselves. The true artist must transcend them. He uses the techniques in order to release something from within himself. And if he has nothing within himself, the techniques are in vain. Everything depends, therefore, upon this internal power of the person. The Alexandrians tried to give a concept of how the human being can attain to the highest part of his own nature. The highest part of the nature of the solar system, according to them, was a series of steps, a ladder connecting heaven and earth. This ladder was the golden chain attributed to Homer, but very much interpreted, at least, by the Alexandrians. This ladder of ascent was not merely an ascent to space, but because of the wall and shell that encloses everything, the ladder is the ascent within the self, the steps of transformation that are necessary to transform the base nature of man into a divinely enlightened soul. And the alchemists had 10 such steps, and they concealed them under chemical terms to represent the various degrees of refinement, the various cycles through which metals and substances must pass in order to be perfected. Basil Valentine and Norton, the old hermetist, said and pointed out, as von Welling also did, that if man as a soul being can perfect himself, if he can transform or transmute the base substances of his own existence and create a psychological gold or a psychological universal medicine for the healing of every ailment that can arise within himself, then also these philosophers believed that it would be conceivable that physical gold could actually be achieved through the similar transmutations of chemical elements. We know that gold has been made. It has been made in recent times, but the amounts made are very minute and the time and effort stupendous. But the ancients claimed that with the proper internal enlightenment, as that of Nicholas Flamel, it would be perfectly possible in the growth of self to parallel this growth by the transmutation of the base substances of nature. Also, by the same procedure, the growth of the individual can become the basis and archetype for the perfection of human society, for the regeneration of the policies of government. It can, if it is properly developed, transform all material institutions subject to and usually involved in corruptions to clarify, purify, and redeem themselves so that every art and science can become a blessing and can continue to unfold from the seed of itself until it achieves the fullness of its own potential. As it ascends, it also devours its adversaries. It swallows up the worms that prevent its own perfection. In the course of ascending from one degree of refinement to another, it also casts off that which is incompatible with its new, higher insight, or transforms that which was previously inadequate. So we, out of the same pattern of things, we develop a concept which we find in Buddhism very clearly set forth, namely the idea that the individual and space are in each one is a commonwealth, a commune of life. Buddha pointed out very definitely that the inner structure of the human body is a political system. It is just as political as any structure governing a state or a nation. The politics of the human body is also subject to every corruption that the politics in the world is subject to. It is subject to lobbies. The human being is filled with lobbies, with parts of itself forever seeking special privileges. It can also bribe itself more quickly than any politician can possibly do. It is also subject to being infested by spies and all kinds of foreign factors attempting to take over. It is seeking to achieve its own internal maturity, while within itself are elements which wish to enslave it. But it can never be enslaved by an outer power unless it first enslaves itself. So that the human body becomes more or less a microcosm of practically everything that concerns the human being. And what it constitutes, the answer to it, lies perhaps in, again, the Hermetic legend. When Alexander the Great came to the Valley of Hebron, he was told that he stood in the presence of an ancient monument that was the tomb of Hermes. He ordered the tomb to be opened, and he found inside nothing but dust. Whatever had been there had gradually disappeared and disintegrated. But in the midst of the dust was an emerald, a magnificent stone, some say produced by art, and therefore an artificial synthetic stone. But it was a stone inscribed, and it is inscribed with the great analogical statement attributed to Hermes Trismegistus, supposed to be the greatest secret of knowledge in all the world. For it said on this stone, "That which has been, will be." And further than that, "That which is true of the greatest is true of the least. All things are the same in pattern, differing only in magnitude. And whatever exists in space is like to that which exists below. And everything that exists below is like to that which exists above." The macrocosm and the microcosm are tied together by indissoluble sympathies that can never be broken.